Thank you very much, Robeson Becher. Of course, I know her as Mara Libby because she taught four of my daughters and was and still is their favorite teacher. So whenever the Robeson calls, I always try to be there for her and this wonderful evening. I just returned a few days ago from a 11-day trip through Poland with a group of about 30 young Jewish men and women. It's an outreach program which I do a few times a year, twice to Eretz Yisrael and once to Poland. And we visit a number of sites. It's a Holocaust-driven trip, but most of it, of course, is Jewish history, because there's a lot of Jewish history, as you realize, in Poland. Poland, as you know, was the quote-unquote America of its day in terms of the amount of Jews that were there. So we started the trip in a city which I'm sure most of you have heard of, called Warsaw, which really was a big Jewish metropolis. Actually, there was a guy on the trip whose name was Seth Warsaw. Wonder where his family was from, right? We got that, of course. And one of the most interesting parts of Warsaw is the Warsaw Cemetery. And the Warsaw Cemetery is absolutely massive. I mean, we're talking, must be 90 acres, 250,000 tombstones, 300,000 people are buried there. How could that be? How can they have 250,000 tombstones yet? Because 50,000 or so were brought to the camps from the ghetto. They perished there from murder, torture, disease, and the rest of it, and put into one large, massive grave. So we actually stayed and stood right there on that spot, and we said Tehillim and certain tefillos, and said Kaddish as well. It's actually fascinating, but it's a weird thing to say. It's a very beautiful cemetery. There's a lot of history there, you know, a lot of etchings on the tombstones, of course, that teach you a lot. So while we were going out, of course, we have a minhag to wash our hands when we leave a cemetery. You're aware of that, right? There's actually three occasions where we wash our hands with a kli, with a cup, according to halacha. We may do it more than that, but actually only three occasions do we wash our hands, and each one has a different reason. Do anyone know those three reasons why when we wash our hands with a kli, with a cup? So I'm not testing you. You won't be examined on this. Well, what?
Nagel
Vasa, which is in the morning, right? So how do we wash that? Right, that's right, you twist your hands, very good, yes. We alternate our hands. There's a ruach tumah that goes from hand to hand, so we take that off. Okay, when else do we wash our hands? With a kli, for we eat bread, right, until it's yadayim, we do that as well. And when we leave a cemetery, very unusual. Until it's yadayim, for bread, we know, is connected to the original washing in the base of Migdash, of course, so zeicher to that. But why when we leave a cemetery? And this was a question that always, well, if you're in a hospital, there's a dead body there, you don't have to wash. So it can't just be that. It can't just be the fact that there's dead bodies there.
I thought you would wash if, let's say, you were in the house with a mace.
In a house with a mace, yeah. Hospitals, though, I don't know if they do that. We're never accustomed to do that. You're a doctor, you work there, people don't usually do it. Something specific about cemeteries that we wash our hands, we leave cemeteries specifically. So I was puzzled by this for many, many years. And I was asked this question many times. I actually wrote a book, which came out 6 months ago. And I wanted to put this question in this. I started doing research into it. And I'll give you the very surprising answer. Maybe we can learn something out from this answer. Anyone know the answer to this question, by the way? It's a very difficult question. It's a great question. There is a mitzvah called the Egla Arufa. Egla Arufa is a young calf. And this calf comes into play in an unusual circumstance where a dead body is found outside of a city. And what they wanted to do was they wanted to figure out where this body came from. So the rabbis, the Torah tells us, would measure the distance from the body to the nearest city, and that city takes on some responsibility. They take a young calf, and the rabbis, the leaders, go out, they take that calf, they shecht it, this young calf. They go to a strong passing stream, and they wash their hands over the blood of this animal. And by doing so, kivichol, say chazal, say the rabbis, they are washing their hands of any responsibility that they may have had. Why would they have responsibility? Because we assume, since this was the closest city, someone wasn't very, very good when it came to the mitzvah of, right, escorting a guest who's not from our home, not from our town. They should have, well, they didn't do that. They didn't make sure they had say l'derech or show them directions, and therefore there's some responsibility to wash their hands. So too, when you leave a cemetery, you wash your hands as well. As if to say, maybe the person I visited, or maybe someone else in this cemetery, I have a little bit of responsibility for, and therefore, as it were, even works in English, I'm washing my hands of any responsibility. Maybe, say the commentators, that's the reason we wash our hands when we leave a cemetery. Interesting, right? So the only other question, there's two other questions, I guess, is why don't we dry our hands? So I didn't find anything on that, but my own thought, so you can take this part or leave it, unlike the rest of the lecture that you have to actually take. Why do we dry our hands? Well, when you dry your hands, the job is done, right? You know, when you do the sitzidayim, you have to actually say, al atilas yadayim, well, your hands are still a little bit wet. And if people dry their hands with a towel and say the brocha, you can't do that, because once you've done the niguv, once you've done the drying of the hands, the actual mitzvah is done. So maybe by drying our hands, we have dried ourselves with responsibility. That's not always there. You know, it's never fully closed. That open relationship is always there. The only thing I haven't figured out, by the way, and you could look into this, or maybe think of your own answer, is why you pass the cup. We don't actually give the cup, you put it down, and the next person picks it up. I'm not sure about that. There's some homework for you. So this came to my mind as we were leaving. I gave this explanation to the guys and girls as we were leaving the cemetery, and they kind of appreciated it. But there's a responsibility that we have. There's a responsibility that we have to the generations that came before us. I didn't know anyone in that cemetery, maybe not in this lifetime, yet we still have a responsibility to people that we don't always know. I want to talk to you for a couple of moments about a topic which is actually mentioned so many times we don't think about it, and that is the topic of memory, how we remember things. So there was a great rabbi, Rabbi Dessler, and Rabbi Dessler, I think he was actually discussing the concept of Rosh Hashanah. Because on Rosh Hashanah, we talk about zichronos, right? Zecher, the remembrances. So he talks about memory is a very important tool. And the Torah itself mentions memory a number of times, right? On Shabbos, Zecher, and Masa Bereishis, many things that the word memory comes up. He says there's three types of memory that we have in life and in Judaism. He says, what type of memory, which we all relate to, are vague memories. We all have vague memories of our childhood. Remember playing in your garden as a kid? Remember your mother giving you something on Shabbos, a gift or something, you know? So those are nice, but they're vague memories we have of the past. Okay, that's one type of memory. He says there's another type of memory, which is an intense memory. Something from your childhood, if you will, that had a big impact on you. You know, a birthday, we remember our bas mitzvah, bar mitzvah. We remember certain things to a much stronger degree. You know what I'm saying? It's like, it's there, you know. A birth of someone, the death of someone, certain things stay with us. He says there's a third type of memory, and he actually says, whatever this means, that this is the memory when it talks to the memory of Hashem. Hashem remembers, it says. What does that mean? Hashem remembers, Hashem can't forget. So he actually understands this. Based upon this third type of memory that he mentions. And he says the third type of memory is a memory that is so strong and so intense that although it happened 30, 40, 50 years ago, it's still happening now. And just the mere memory of it starts you crying or starts you laughing because it's so vital and it's such a major part of your psychological makeup that it's happening right now. That's what it means, by the way, when he says Hashem remembers. Hashem remembers because everything is present for Hashem right now. Past, present, and future. Haya, hove, yeah, right? So yud with a K, with a vav, with a K, right? That's the past, present, future. For Hashem, there is no past, present, future. It's all one. Hashem is in Gan Eden right now with Adam and Chava. Hashem is right here with us right now. And Hashem is with Mashiach. There is no past, present, future, because it's all that third type of memory that is present. But we can tap into that sometimes by remembering certain things which are so intense that they're happening right now. And have all these Jews in therapy, right? And they're all crying. And they're like, what's the problem? It goes, oh, my life is terrible. Tell me about your childhood. What childhood? I said my wife hates me, my husband hates me, my things are I'm just in a bad situation, right? I've lost my living, everything's terrible. You know, it's all... What's got to do with my childhood? Because your childhood's happening right now. It's so intense, those experiences, that they're here with you in the present. That is the power of memory. And by the way, that's the idea, not for now, different discussion for another time, the idea of remembering Shabbos, right? Zecher. The idea of remembering Shabbos, Zecher Yom HaShabbos, is it has to be present right now. But we'll leave that aside. There is something then, let's go to the next point, something called national collective memory, which means there's some things that didn't per se happen to us, but they're part of the national memory of our people that we still tap into by learning, discussing, understanding. So though we didn't personally experience them, they happened 60, 70 years ago, like the Holocaust. They happened a few hundred years ago. They happened 1,000, they happened 2,500 years ago. Yet the mere memory of them, it's as though they're happening right now. And although I personally didn't experience it, as a people, as an we feel it. And that's part of the idea of remembering Yetzias Mitzrayim. I wasn't a neighbor in Egypt. I have no desire to go there. I'll be scared to go there at this point in my life. Having said that, it's part of what happened to us as a people. I can tap into that energy and boop, put myself into it right now. A little while ago, a terrible thing happened. 2,000 years ago, our temple was destroyed. That happened on the ninth day of the Jewish month of Av. Now, one of the problems we have nowadays, let's be honest about it, and we're all aware of this, is not so much that we're upset that it happened. What we're really upset about is that we can't relate to it anymore. That's really the feeling which many of us have today's day and age. That's worth being upset about, right? It's worth being upset that I don't feel the upset that I should do. That upsets me. By the way, that's still something. 2015, that's not too bad to feel that itself. You know, it's another thing. You know, I remember I was in yeshiva as a bacha, and they just started this whole movie thing. You know the whole movie thing? Everyone's watching movies on Tisha B'Av, you know what I'm saying? When I grew up, I wasn't like this. So I don't know. I mean, suddenly everyone's watching movies on Tisha B'Av, you know? Tisha B'Av was, and I mean, I remember, I was a good bacha. Don't look at me now. I was a good bacha. And I went to Rosh Yeshiva, and I said, Rosh Yeshiva, I feel a little guilty. I'm enjoying these movies. You know what I'm saying? It's like Tisha B'Av. Movie day! Here we go. Let's go watch the movies together, you know? And we're inspired, and it's an emotional movie, but... And I said, I'm finding it difficult, you know, that I'm enjoying it. And you know what Rosh Yeshiva said to me? He said a fantastic, beautiful thing. He said this to me. He said to me, what happens when Mashiach comes? What happens to Tisha B'Av? It turns around into a Yom Tov. It's going to be a good day, a celebration. We're going to, let me put it into English. We're going to get to eat. We like to eat, right? Remember, there's 6 fast days in the Jewish calendar. There's 80 feasting days. Right? It shows where we put our desires. So he said, when Tisha B'Av, when Mashiach comes, it's going to turn to a day of celebration. Right? Why? It's all the discussion, because we're going to look back and understand all these terrible things. Ultimately, we're necessary in order for us to have the full geula, the redemption, and therefore we're going to be happy. He says, the fact we have started to feel a little bit happy on Tisha B'Av means we're getting close. Is that nice? Means we're getting a little sniff of that. It didn't just happen overnight. It's a little slow movement in, but we're not there yet. We're not there yet. We're getting close. We may start to feel it a little bit, but still, it's a day of great mourning for us, the Jewish people. There's a Mishnah that talks about a certain sea creature, a certain aquatic creature called the Kelev Hayam. The Kelev Hayam. What's a Kelev Hayam? What's a Kelev? A dog. Yam is the sea, a sea dog. What creature is this? I'm not too sure. Walrus, sea lion, I'm not too sure. right? Dolphin, I'm not sure. Some creature they call the Kelev Hayam. So why are they discussing this creature? They want to work out whether it's a land creature or a sea creature. Land or sea. Why? Okay, that's an interesting discussion. Trying to figure it out. Because of Tumah and Tara, purity and impurity. So the mission goes backwards and forwards. Do you know how they actually found out the decision of whether this Kelev Hayam is a land creature or a sea creature? They chased it. And they made it very, very scared. That's what they did to it. We're going to freak out this creature so much that we're going to want to see where it goes. And they chased it, and I believe when it got scared, this creature goes into the water. That's its natural habitat. The habitat of the Kelev Hayam is the water, because that's where it goes when it's scared. So I heard from someone a beautiful idea based upon this Mishnah. Where do we go when we are scared? Because when you go where you are scared, when you have troubles, when you have challenges, defines who you are as well. If we run to the news to read the pontificatings of the reporters and journalists, which we do, then that's where we are. And that's what we are. That's going to define us as a person. Or do we go and run to Hashem? Do we daven? Do we learn? What is our home when we are scared? These are scary times for our people. It is no coincidence that during the 9 days, and by the way, there were many other dates that were chosen for this final deal with Iran that came through. This is the sixth or seventh one, I believe. I have the list at home. I printed it out. But this date that it just fell in during the 9 days happens to be the final date where that agreement was made. This is a scary time for us as a people, as a nation, and not just in Eretz Yisrael. This has global implications. You know, the Green Movement has a great saying. Think global, act local. Why do they say that? Because you want to save the planet. You want to stop the oceans filling up with plastic and ozone and all the other stuff that's happening in the world. Because you've got to think a bit. You can't act global. You've got to act local. So you take your little plastic bottle and put it in recycling, which my wife is obsessed with, by the way. If I put a plastic bottle in the garbage, I got to fish it out. I put it into recycling. You speak to her. She is obsessed with this. She speaks to people about it. Oh, my goodness. Okay. So, but what am I doing? That little plastic bottle, I mean, in terms of the ocean, it's garnish. It's nothing at all. That's not the point. I'm thinking global, but you've got to act local, because this little bottle is going to add up to your little bottle, your little bottle, and eventually we'll have a lot of little bottles, and eventually somehow we're going to be impacting the world. It's a very Jewish idea. We as a people, we think global, but we act local. So there's terrifying things happening. What can I do? So you call a senator maybe if you're a fanatic, you know, or you'll go on a rally if you want to, I don't know, but ultimately what we're going to be doing is acting local. What's acting local going to do? I mean, how's that going to impact the entire world? I may not see it, but if we all act local and be involved in our local communities and our mishpachas with chesed and goodness and kindness, ultimately that's going to impact the world. That's the Jewish view of how to change the world. We're thinking global. We want the world to be a better place, but ultimately we have to act better in ourselves. But we're held back. We're held back. You know, I take my... You know, when you have kids, obviously, you take them to the zoo. For some reason, we've got to take our kids to the zoo. You visit the animals, that's what we do. So, I took my kids to the zoo many years ago, and go see the elephants. You know, elephants, they're good to look at. Right? They've got big noses, they look Jewish. So we went to visit the elephants, and I noticed that one of the elephants was tied up. How do they tie up an elephant to stop it moving? It's a big creature. That's a big beast. So you'd have thought chains and everything. They don't do that. You see what they do? They actually wrap one of its legs with a rope and attach it to a peg in the ground. This is how they tie up. And why do they do this? Because elephants are very tough animals. An elephant can knock down a tree, can move large logs and trunks of trees if it want to. And yet there's a little bit of a little bit, and in the ground, and it could take it out in a second. So the reason is because as a young calf, the elephant is tied with that same rope and that same peg. And at that age, it can't get away. Yet as it gets older and older and older, it still remembers its childhood that won't allow it to break that rope and unplug that peg in the ground. And therefore, even though it's perfectly capable of ripping it out with one little sneeze if it wants to, in its mind, it's stuck, it's trapped. So I think we're all a little bit the same. I know I am. That all of us have little things that hold us back. Little memories that we have from our childhood, little experiences that hold us back. And really, they feel so big to us, I can never overcome that particular nisoyon, that particular test, that particular challenge, that chisaron, which we all have. And yet, actually, it's so small that if we just learn a good technique and can break out of that childhood kind of like fantasy world, we could probably pluck it out of the ground. So the topic which usually we kind of revolve around, which I've been speaking about so far, we'll tie it together, which we speak about this time of year, is Midos, his character traits. And that's usually spoken about because when calamities happen to us, even 2,000 years ago, we still feel as though we're responsible for them. And although in the outside world, in the Western world that we live in, people will look at other reasons why things happen to us. The Jewish people have always had a tradition that when bad things happen to us, we have to defend ourselves and get rid of the pursuer and the danger and the threat. But ultimately, we have to reflect inwards and say, well, why did this happen to us? What's lacking in us that allowed this to happen? We take some responsibility, or we take some lesson that has to come out of what happened to us. So what's that called? That's called working on your Midos, right? Midos is really the key theme which seems to come up, and Chazal backs this up, especially with Tisha B'Av, right? They say, why was the base of Midos destroyed? And say, because of Sinas Chinam, there was hatred between us as a people. And the fact, say Chazal, that the Beis HaMikdash is not rebuilt means that we are still connected to that Mida, that negative trait, which goes right back. I want to talk about the word Mida, though, because we all talk about it, and Uncle Moishi sings about it, right? So what exactly is it? We have teachers here. And everyone's like, you've got to work on your Midos. You know, everyone's very into Midos. So the word Midos is actually a very interesting word. The word Midos is plural for the singular, which is Mida. What does the word Mida mean? A measure. That's right. This table has Midos, right? It's got a Mida. It's got a certain measurement to it. Right? When you're like, in the Parsha of Shidduchim, right, you want to know about, you know, what are the Midos of the guy, right? What is Midos? Well, I don't mean his height, 6'2", or if he's Jewish, 5'3", right? We want to know, right, what this person is all about. And the word is very, very good. Why would the word measurement equal character traits? Midos is character traits. Why would it be character traits? Because how do you measure up? Works in English too. I want to share another idea with you, however. I want to share another idea, which may be related to this as well. Why do we use the word Mida to define this idea of working on our character traits, which really says the Rambam is what it's all about? The Rambam says, in Hilchos Tumura, I believe, that ultimately the entire purpose of being alive, being Jewish, being involved in Torah and mitzvos, is in order to improve your midos. That's the Rambam. For some reason, that Rambam is lost somewhere, but it's a Rambam, Mishnah Torah. What's the purpose to all life, he says? Everything is to become a better person. Every mitzvah you do, you want to become a better person. You eat matzah, that's making you a better person. Okay, some stuff we understand, helping people across the street, honoring parents, giving charity, but the other stuff too, putting on tefillin, right? Lighting candles, keeping shabbat, whatever it is, every single mitzvah ultimately has to lead you into becoming a better individual. That's ultimately what it's all about. So the word mida is also very, very good. So I'll give you an analogy to help define maybe just another interpretation. Imagine my daughter comes home, God bless you, my daughter comes home and, you know, when she was 3 years old, and she's got mud on her shoes. I'm like, could you, before you walk through the house, could you wipe your feet on the mat? So she comes in, and I walk up 2 minutes later, and I see little muddy footprints throughout the entire house. And I ask her, is that you? She's like, no, must have been him, right? His feet are that big, right? So it doesn't make sense. So I'm like, naughty girl, what did Abba tell you? Abba told you to wipe your feet before walking around. That's it. You're not going to medical school. We had a lot of money saved up. We were all ready to put you into medical school. That's it. Done. Me and Mommy, we're going on vacation with the cash. See you in 2 weeks. That would be absurd. Why? Because the punishment doesn't fit the crime. You can maybe hold back, I don't know, a cookie for dinner or early to bed or whatever punishments my wife ends up giving the kids, because I just let them off everything, of course. Right? So why do we do that? Because it has to measure. So too, when we react to people, how do we measure our response? Someone upsets us. Someone gets angry with us. Someone irritates us. Someone cuts us in traffic. Someone is in the 10 items or less checkout, and they have 10,000 items. All these things irritate us incredibly. And the older I get, the more irritated I get. Do you have that as well? I mean, you're all very young over here. Except you. You're like really old, okay? But the rest of us. And the more this happens, the more irritated I get. So when that happens, I got a choice, right? Do I completely in their face, which they probably deserve, but how do I know that my punishment fits the crime? I have to measure my response. So it's the reflective aspect of mida and midos that I have to put into action when I'm going through life. Interesting, the one of the main midos we're all working on, hopefully, which is the big one for all of us, and that is anger, one of kas, which is a whole discussion in and of itself, but it's a big one, which we all have to try to deal with. And interesting, the Gemara calls kas the inner teacher. It's actually the name of a book by Zelig Pliskin, which I have on my shelf. Right? Called anger. Why it's called the inner teacher? Why would anger be called the inner teacher? Well, a number of reasons, just like the word midos. Because what do I get angry about? What makes me angry teaches me about who I am. Do I get angry if someone cuts in front of me in traffic? Right? Or do I control myself and think, well, maybe they're on the way to an emergency, maybe they had a really, really bad day, right? Maybe they've got to be home in 2 minutes or their husband and wife's going to kill them. Who knows? Could be. I can conjure up a lot of ideas in order to do that. My job is to try to formulate such ideas in my head. You can actually go to extremes when doing this in order to calm ourselves down. And by doing this, we are teaching ourselves. What we get angry about also is very important. We get angry if we break a nail, okay, if someone drops something. What we're saying is that's more important than my feelings towards you. Right? If you lose your temper, which unfortunately we all do sometimes, we're actually saying that that event is having more importance for me than your feelings. Right? One is one over. So it's taught me something about myself, ultimately, what's important to me more than my relationship to you. I want to share another idea. I wasn't going to mention it, but it came to my head, so I must mention it. Someone taught this to me many years ago. It came to my head. Now, one of the things that we also all deal with is rejection. This is, I would say, for the younger people that are alive today, the young generation, the millennials, as they're called, which is, I think, 18 to 30-year-olds or something like that, they deem it up with rejection. We don't take rejection well. Rejection by friends, family, students, teachers, you know. I think the older generation, they were able to handle it better, you know. I remember my parents would say that when they would get grades at school, they would get a 92. And they would show it to their parents. And what would their parents say? where's the other eight? You know? They said, you know what I'm saying? That's the kind of like generation they grew up with. I've heard that from a lot of people. If we tell that to our kids, right, and don't get, 92? Oh my, OMG. That is fantastic. You've got to like, you know, wax lyrical for half an hour, thanking them so much for, you know, not being kicked out of yeshiva again. So this becomes our, you know, this is the generation we're in. Rejection, like that generation, they were, I don't know, maybe they had thicker skin, or maybe they're affected by it and, I don't know, kept it in somehow, you know. Maybe it came out some other way. But rejection is a big, big problem for our generation. One of the things that really leads to a lot of problems and challenges in life. Anyone here been rejected before, by the way? I'm being serious. Anyone here been rejected? Yeah? Anyone?
Everyone.
You've all been rejected? You sure? Sometimes. You said everyone? What's your name?
Gila.
Gila? That's my mother-in-law's name. Could you leave, please? I'm only joking. You stay right there. That was terrible. Oh, I'm only joking. I love my mother-in-law. You know the difference between in-laws and outlaws? Outlaws are wanted. No, I'm only joking. Okay, so Gila, you said you were rejected. Give me an example, if you don't mind, of a time where you were rejected. Any example?
Interview.
Job interview. Okay, you applied for a job. What happened?
Never hear back from them, or they say thank you anyway, have a nice life.
How did that make you feel?
Rejected. I mean, gone to the next one.
Not a nice feeling, right? No. You felt rejected. It wasn't a nice feeling. Anybody else? Marie Libby, you've been rejected before? Nobody rejects Mara Libby Becha. That's impossible. You've been rejected before, right?
Absolutely.
You applied for something, you wanted something, and you rejected from getting it. Not a nice feeling. I want to tell you a very important secret over here, which I hope you'll enjoy. None of you have ever been rejected. You think you have, but you haven't. What you did was you created a story. Now, let's look at your job application, Gila. You applied for a job. You filled out a letter, you mailed it off, or maybe you emailed it. And then a few days later, you maybe got an interview, you sat down, you had a conversation with someone, and then you went home. And then 2 days later, you got a phone call or a letter, an email saying that you're not going to get the job. Now, you made a story in your mind. See, in your mind, you made a story. I'm not good enough. I'm not worthy. No one loves me. I'm so stupid. That's a story. Now, it's a valid story. You're not crazy. You didn't think you were attacked by zombies. But actually, what you did was you created a story. I asked you what happened. What actually happened was you put words onto a piece of paper, put it into an envelope and sent it off. Then you sat down with two people or one person, you had a conversation, then you went home, then you got another piece of paper. That's what happened. But what happens is we make stories about everything that happens to us in our lives. Everything, every occurrence becomes a whole story, a whole production. They don't love me. They're so rude towards me. They're so mean. I always have to say that. And she's so irritating. And how can she do that to me? And my mother-in-law said that. And my daughter doesn't love me. My kids hate me. And everyone is like, these are all stories. But actually what you're meant to do in life, and there's actually a Rambam, I believe, in Hilchos Deis that actually says this implicitly, that most of the things that happen to us are hevel. Hevel havalim. What's hevel? Hevel is steam. Steam is a very interesting word. That's a literal word. It means nothingness. But hevel, what does that mean? Steam you can see, but it's not there. But it can still burn you. Right? It has no mamashas. It has no physicality, but we still feel it. So we spend our entire lives doing what? Our entire lives we spend making stories. And that really, ladies, is what life is all about. We're walking around making... Oh, you're wondering why I'm carrying this around? Oh, this is an argument I had about 4 years ago with my wife, you see. And I carry it with me, and I'm okay. You know, I got to sleep with it, and I wake up with it. And getting up in the morning is a little bit difficult because it kind of weighs me down a little bit. I got to carry it around, you know. And I have a chair, I take with me everywhere as well. That's an argument from my childhood that I really got over. It's a little scar, you see. And I felt rejected from that. So I'm walking around with a chair and a shtender my entire life, you see. And most of us are walking around with all this stuff, all these feelings of rejection, when really what we're meant to do, and this is the real avoda of life, is to put it down. And to realize that maybe the stories I've attached to all these events in my life, and all these interactions, and all these relationships, ultimately are just stories that I've created, but aren't really what happened. I had a student of mine who a teacher in the city, and she was put into a room with two other girls. And the girls turned around to her after the second day she was there and said, "We don't want you in the room with us. I won't give her a reason." And they made her leave, and she had to room with someone else. Imagine that. How terrible. And she was upset for so long. So I said, "What happened?" And she said, "So mean to me. I couldn't do that. I was in the room with them, and they said, 'Don't like me,' and they kept making and I just had to move out of the room." So I said, "Nice story, but what happened?" Because what do you mean? Because I told you, no. What happened was, you went to a room, you had a conversation, you put your clothing into the suitcase, you carried the suitcase next door, and you unpacked it. That's what happened. You made a whole story to make it fit in to your personal narrative that you're walking around with. But that's not what happened. That's a nice story that you created. I want to tell you a secret about Jewish men, which you may be aware of. I'm sure many of you are married. Jewish men, and men in general, don't like to ask for directions. They will drive around for 3 hours rather than stop and ask for directions. And if they do manage to stop and ask for directions, as soon as they hear the directions, they forget them and carry on getting lost. Okay? It's like one left, two right, and then two left, and the second one, and make a right by the end, and then like, "I got no idea what he said, but I can't ask him again because I'm embarrassed to ask this stranger one more time which way I'm going, so I'm going to get lost again." Hashem blessed us, however, with a GPS. GPS is fantastic. GPS stands for God's Protective System. It protects us from having fights with our wives, because now we have someone who lives in our car with a nice, calm voice. No matter what mistakes you make. I should mention this to my wife. She didn't like it, but I'll tell you anyway. It's always calm. Make a left. Second right. What happens if you miss your turn? Your husband gets angry with you. You get angry with your husband. Rerouting. Wouldn't that be nice? Wife says to me, "Oh, honey, reroute." I'm like, "Oh, that's nice." Not, "You missed the turn again. I told you. Make a right. You're not listening to me." No, those days are over. Rerouting. Makes you feel good. Doesn't it feel good? It's wonderful. I heard from someone that when it comes to relationships with people, it's hard for us to improve our relationships with people, which, of course, is the theme of Tishabab in this time of the year. But what we can do is start with inanimate objects. And we in Judaism, actually, place significance on inanimate objects and sometimes treat them as though they are animate objects. Can you think of examples where we treat inanimate objects as though they're animate? Our phones. That's not a good thing. Yes, yes, our phones. That's right. I love you, I love you. I'm sorry, dear, you here? Right. No, I don't just mean that. I mean in Jewish life, of talking, of course. Well, the challah, for example, right? What do? We cover the challah. What's the reason we cover the challah? We don't want to get embarrassed, right? You've heard this famous midrash, I believe, because of the wine, making the brach, you should make a brach over the challah first, because it's Shabbos, you have to make a brach over the wine. This is an ancient tradition. Where else do we see inanimate objects being thought about? Moshe Rabbeinu, right? The first three Makos, right? Moshe Rabbeinu was not allowed to turn the water into blood because the water saved him, okay? He couldn't bring out the frogs either, okay? Came out of the water. And of course, Aaron HaKohen had to bring out the kinnim as well, right? Because the sand protected Moshe Rabbeinu when it buried the Mitzri that he killed. We see that Moshe Rabbeinu had to have, why? Well, the sand feels it, the water feels it, the challah feels it, no. It's not about the object, it's about us. By us having a karsa tov to inanimate objects, then maybe we can start to work on ourselves and start to treat animate objects a little bit better as well. And so, I started doing that myself. I found an animate object that talks to me and loves me, and I called her Suri. And Suri is the GPS in my car. And on my phone, and she says, "Make a left," and I'm like, "Thank you so much, I appreciate that." "Make a right," okay, rerouting. Ah, I made a mistake, I apologize, I'm working on it, you see. And if we start to relate to inanimate objects with more respect, maybe we'll start to relate to each other with more respect as well. It becomes a training ground. That's exactly what Moshe Rabbeinu was told to do. And that is something that we can incorporate into our lives. We live, however, and we'll finish with this idea, in a throwaway culture. There's actually nothing we keep. I went to a conference, rabbinical conference, a few years ago, and Dr. Rabbi Abraham Twersky was up on the stage, and someone asked why we have such high divorce rates. And he held up a plastic cup. You heard the story before? He held up a plastic cup, I think I mentioned it before, and he said, this is the reason. We've created a disposable culture, right? We throw away everything. It just goes and throws and throws and throws, you see? Pens, we don't keep pens. When I grew up, I got a nice Mont Blanc for my bar mitzvah with a white blob on top. I thought it was a Star of David. It's actually not. It's a mountain peak, but don't worry about it. Okay? And you felt a connection to it. You had a relationship to a pen. I mean, like, oh, my pen, I love it. But you have a relationship to this pen. You have a relationship to things, objects. You know, now something breaks, you throw it away, you get a new one. Right? Your brakes fail, you throw it away, you get a new one. Your phone breaks, you throw away, get a new one. No one fixes a radio anymore. Can you just fix my radio? Fix the radio. Throw it away, get a new one. If a relationship breaks, throw it away, get a new one. That's the reason, he said, for the high divorce rates. This disposable culture. A profound thought. So in response, I like to say that in Torah and Judaism, we have relationships with animate objects, inanimate objects. We relate to them. We feel connected to them. We have the candlesticks that have been passed down through the generations. We have the tefillin that are kadosh to us, right? We feel they're alive. They carry something with them. By relating to these objects, really we're learning to relate to each other. They are a metaphor for the living people who are around us that we have to have concern for as well, who ultimately want our best interest in most cases, if we can redevelop the story in order to fit that paradigm. I'm hoping that this Mossy Shabbos and Sunday will be the last. We'd have to get there even before, but if we do get there, the last Tisha B'Av, we have to suffer in exile, and Emes Hashem will have the Binyan Beis Hamikdash that we lost 2,000 years ago rebuilt very soon in Har HaBayis and its proper location. Thank you very much. Thank you. Anyone who can stay?
Yeah, some people do, but they wash hands after a levaya also.
After a levaya.
In the funeral home.
In the funeral home. Because the same thing over there, the mace is there, I guess, yeah.